Brother Clint. Appreciated that. How many caught when we were singing the song that we had? Just take one and pass them around. That it was written by Count Zinzendorf. He was a Moravian, one of the leaders of the Moravians, and the Moravians did an excellent job of evangelizing the Native Americans in my area of Pennsylvania, the Delaware Indians. And not just evangelizing them, winning them to a new life in Christ, practical changes. Instead of being hunters, they became farmers. Instead of living in random teepees wherever, their longhouses wherever they were, and with the drunken pagans, they now lived in orderly rows of log homes and became non-resistant instead of fighting each other. And so he wasn't ashamed to tell someone from another culture that this is Jesus' teaching. This is what Jesus expects from his followers, not just Mennonites and Amish. And I think that's important for us to keep in mind. His teachings aren't just for us. They're for everybody. There, we're going to send those around too. And I'd like you all to get one of these. All right. You should have a sheet that says Agape CASP Leadership Training Meeting, like that. Everybody have one of those now? Yeah, okay. Well, you might want to take some notes. I learned a long time ago, if you hear something, you remember about 10%. If you see something and hear something, you learn about 20% that you can retain. And if you make some notes while you're hearing and seeing, why you retain about 30%. So this is to help us with retention today, and you can carry these notes home with you. So let's start with some introductions. I'm Rick Hess, Peace and a Baptist Brotherhood in Sunbury, Pennsylvania, a church planted by Harmony Christian Fellowship down in Myerstown. And we'll just go around the room. If you want to just stand to your feet, shout out who you are and where you're from. Okay, and can we have our sister stand and introduce yourself? Okay. You say, well, I thought this is a men's meeting. Well, it isn't necessarily, and you're going to find that CASP is more than just men. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. We'd like to have an introduction to CASP. Just a brief, because we're glad to have Brother Phil Mast with us. Phil is the director of the CASP program for Christian Aid Ministries, and so he's going to be giving us some information a little bit later. But just a general introduction. Let's see if I get the right book here. Who knows when the last draft was? Who can tell me? You're in the right zone. Yes, you are. I believe it was 1973. Is that correct, Phil? And the war ended in 75. So you could be asking yourself, why all this planning and concerning ourselves with a draft? if there hasn't been one in 50 years. And we're going to get into that a little bit too. So one of the things I just wanted to cover here is CASP has a lot of good, useful information and material. Today, when you're done, your break's over, or you want to go home, or in between, we have here a manual for each one of the leaders of a region, CASP program manual. That's going to give you details that we cannot give you today, and you will not be able to retain if we tried to. So that's going to be important for each regional representative to take one of them back with him. Beside that, we have a Harmony CASP handbook from our last project, which was down in Mayfield, Kentucky. And you can take, as a leader, take one of those along too to your area, because that can be a prototype of a handbook for your projects later. And then finally, we have a good number of these, so please help yourself to these draft information manuals. CAM has put a lot of effort into getting this kind of material printed and put together for us, so we're not blindsided on what's going on around us. Okay, so I'd like to get into conservative Anabaptist service programs. Since most of you are too young to remember that Vietnam War much, I do remember it. I wasn't old enough to be drafted. I was 11 years old when the last draft was, but I do remember men going off and being drafted. I was not raised in a conservative home, so I had an uncle that went to Vietnam. I had five other uncles that were all in the National Guard. Raised Mennonite, but no vision. They lost the vision. Family left the conservative church in the 60s, and that's what happened. So they went to the military. Those who held to a conscientious objector's position in Vietnam had the privilege of 1W service. 1W service was deferment. You were given a job somewhere. A lot of times, maybe in a hospital or being a DHIA inspector on a dairy farm. Those were different things that were done, forestry jobs and so on. But some of the things that happened, we were kind of caught unprepared when it took place, that young men were sent into situations. Take the hospital situation, for instance. Many of the men were sent off to war. So an unproportionate amount of women were working in the hospital. Now our young men get placed in the hospital beside this unproportionate amount of men whose men have been taken away. Does that sound like a recipe for good moral, ethical situation? And unfortunately, there were way too many failures, immaturity, lack of oversight by the churches, and so it was important to try to find something better. So conservative Anabaptist service programs, church constituency qualifications. We want to talk about that just a little bit. All church groups that participate in the conservative Anabaptist service program shall meet the following requirements. They must adhere to a biblical confession of faith and practice that is in harmony with the CASP statement of faith. Now, stop and think about that just a little bit. I gave you a sheet. That sheet was just approved yesterday at a board meeting with CASP. It's just an update on a confession of faith for CASP, and it matches the same confession of faith that Christian Aid Ministries uses for their ministry worldwide. Then I gave you a little green booklet that has printed on it. It says Peace Anabaptist. It's actually Harmony Christian Fellowship's confession of faith. I'm not asking you to adopt it. I want you to know about it. I want you to know what it says, because upon that confession of faith, we were approved to be part of CASP. So you need to know that. And if you don't currently in your fellowship have a confession of faith, I'm going to really challenge you. Why? Maybe you just haven't got it done yet, but it is an important document. We have been blessed with that since we put it together at Harmony. It actually started in Haiti. We needed a confession of faith down there, and I took the old charity confession and I tried to translate it into Creole with a translator who was fluent in four languages, and he could not take the antiquated statements being made in the charity confession and put them into words for the Creole people. So I thought, a council of us, three of us, a committee, Brother Clinton Oberholzer, Brother John Ray Nault, and myself, worked at reworking the old Charity Confession of Faith. Not that we wanted something different, we wanted something with better clarity, and the verses behind each line so that they match up and you can actually study. And when that translated into Creole, Life Literature got a hold of it, and they have distributed it all over the island, and the men love it. The pastors love it because they said, we're a mile wide on worship, but we're an inch deep on doctrine. We don't have anything like this down here. We translate it into Swahili, and it's been spread all around East Africa because the same thing. We're a mile wide on worship, an inch deep on doctrine, and we realize how important it is to have a course charted for doctrine. It's not going to resolve all church issues by any stretch of the imagination, but it definitely helps to guide us and say, here as a group is what we are. And when a new person comes, they don't have to say, well, what are the expectations here? This is what this group believes. Do I want to be a part of them, or do I not want to be a part of them? And so it is critical. So those are two little pieces that come together that I want you to consider. Take those with you there for you. Shall be willing to commit to financial and human resources to properly administer their alternative service program. Shall commit to develop and operate the program projects under the direction, structure, and guidelines of CASP. They shall provide a biannual service exercise that meets CASP approvals. That means a project that shows that we are draft ready. If in the event of a draft, we are prepared, we have the infrastructure in place, or at least partially in place, that we can go forward and we can address the issue of giving alternative service to conscientious objectors among us. That's the point of the CASP program. They shall provide and oversee spiritual nurture of that service unit, one of the things that was lacking in 1W many times, not always. They shall be accountable to report to CASP Board of Directors for any service programs operating under their church constituency, and the constituencies with more than five congregations may be offered a seat at the CASP Board of Directors. Small groups would find representation otherwise. Now, it does take about five churches working together to put together a project. We found that out on our first project back in 2017. Okay, so that's just kind of an introduction, whet your appetite a little bit on what this is all about today. I'd like you to take a look at the sheet, the little paper or stack of papers they're called, in defense of conscience. Now, if you're going to be part of the CASP program, it's going to be important that you know what you believe about conscientious objection. And I'm going to tell you why I say that. I was burdened. I was asked by the Charity Christian Fellowships, and I should kind of back up a little bit. I was an evangelical pastor for 9 years. And I just, the more I studied the scripture, the more I was convinced of Anabaptist doctrines. Now, you go back, and I said already, my dad was raised Mennonite, but I wasn't raised in a conservative home. So it wasn't just home. It wasn't just doing what dad did. I started studying, and the more I studied, the more I was convinced, and the less I was convinced the church I was a part of was going the right direction. I had come from an ungodly teenage years and rebellion and just you name it, and I was finally born again, running towards the church, and I found the church running toward me, which was great. We should have just embraced in the middle, right? No, we ran past each other. They were running headlong toward the world, and I was running away from it. And so I got involved with the charity movement. I'll never forget, February 1990, sat the first time at Charity Christian Fellowship, heard Moses Stolzfus preaching to a packed house of about 500 people. The windows were open in the middle of February. It was so hot in there from so many people. And he just preached with power for an hour and a half straight. And when he was done, I wished I could have heard a little bit more. Because that man had passion. Wasn't always right, but he had passion. He believed in what he was promoting. And if we're going to be representing CASP and representing conscientious objectors, we need to be committed to that stand. So let's talk about it. I'm going to just quickly read this. In defense of conscience, what is the thing called conscience? We find it already working in Adam and Eve after they ate of the forbidden fruit. It was no doubt what revealed their nakedness and caused them to hide from God. The Bible reveals it to be a created part of all human beings who have been made in the image of God himself. We, like God, are three-part beings, body, soul, and spirit. So imagine three circles crossing over each other. You look down the illustration there, kind of a crude illustration. Now, before I confuse you completely, each of those three circles should have three more circles inside them. We are a fearfully and wonderfully made being on all levels. So I want us to get that piece of it. Our body has three parts: our flesh, our senses, and our appetites. But the conscience needs to touch them, but it doesn't dwell there. In our souls are also three parts: our mind, will, and emotions. A well-ordered life will have these three areas ruled by the conscience, but it doesn't dwell there. Our spirit, originated with God himself, is the place of our connection, our worship with our Creator, the light of intuition, and our personal conscience. That still small voice who hears from the Holy Spirit and guides us into obedience, honor for God, and truth. Through the new birth, the conscience is purged from dead works, past sin, previous hardness, and made it not operate effectively. It is made alive, tender, responsive to its new Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. A good illustration of that is just above there. You'll see that little picture of the man on ice. That's Dirk Willems in Holland, who's being chased by his persecutors. The man falls through the ice when Dirk made it across. Dirk goes back onto the ice, risks his own neck, saves the man's life, is arrested, is tried, and I think it was 2 weeks later, was burned alive for his faith. Because he believed that I need to do what Jesus said. I need to love those that hate me. Since the beginning of the church at Pentecost, the conscience of believers have been challenged and tried by the enemies of our soul. To maintain the conscience is critically important, yet many earthly leaders have failed to see the importance, even the priority, of God-renewed conscience versus their own will, whims, and laws. One of these critical areas of conscience has repeatedly been that of obeying the commands of Christ concerning how we treat our enemies. Those who persecute us and despitefully use us, turning the other cheek, going the extra mile and not resisting evil, believing every soul has been made in the image of God and their life is precious to him, we count it better to die than to kill. We need to be committed to that. Now, when I was in Haiti serving under Charity Christian Fellowship, we had a leadership training seminar. And I invited a couple elders down from Charity, 1998. Anyway, wanted to go through some of the points of the Confession of Faith, and one of them was non-resistance. And a brother said to me, "I can't take that topic." I said, "Why?" He said, "I wouldn't know where to start to teach it." That scared me. That scared me. And I am going to say that I believe it's your vision that we don't have that amongst us. That we have a vision and we know what we believe and we're going to go forward and not only be able to say I believe it, but explain why to the point that I can convince others. That's important. Suffering love, it well describes our Lord's example and his command to his followers. From the first century through the third, pagan Rome persecuted believers mainly for not worshiping the emperor, but would have occasionally tried to exercise their authority to have men serve the nation as soldiers or in politics. The church, for the most part, stood strong, declaring that we will be of more value to the empire on our knees than bearing your sword. There were some who suffered and a few notable cases of martyrdom. There seemed to be such a clear distinction between the two kingdoms, and because the church was fulfilling their calling, the secular history notes this as the 200-year golden age of peace in the Roman Empire, Pax Romanus. During the third century, several waves of severe persecution attempted to annihilate the church, which by this time had grown quite large and in some cases weary. How many of you knew that by the third century, there had been so many people that had defected, recanted their faith in place of persecution, that the church finally said, "We won't baptize you. We'll put you on probation for 3 years." I don't think that's a good plan. Go ye therefore into all the world, teaching, baptizing, teaching them to obey all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, what? I am with you always. That's what we can't forget. God in the flesh said it. God who cannot lie. I am with you always. In the fourth century, the unthinkable happened. The Emperor Constantine proposed a marriage of the Church of Jesus Christ and the pagan Roman Empire. Through this marriage, the hybrid harlot Babylon was born. This new organization tried hard to resemble the true Church of Jesus Christ, but it was not. Several decades later, capable men like Augustine and Jerome took it upon themselves to rewrite the last will and testament of the Lord Jesus to fit their own Roman Empire and then called it holy. One of the things that were totally turned about was the use of the sword and political power in what they presented as the just war theory. This, along with mandatory infant baptism, just torture, sacerdotalism, or salvation through this church and its sacraments alone, were some of the components that helped plummet the Western world into the Dark Ages as the Roman Empire collapsed. Ironically, when the church made peace with war, there hasn't been many decades in the last 1700 years since then that have not seen bloody wars often fought between professing Christians. The idea that every heretic, Jew, and eventually Muslim must either convert or die was a natural fruit of this kind of organization. And you know, as I was doing some of this more thorough study during that time period, it dawned on me. I've worked with Muslims for years, and I never really thought about it. Muslims did not invent convert by the sword. They didn't. They were taught that by the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church had been doing it for hundreds of years before Islam was ever born. And Muhammad's first wife was a nominal Catholic. So we often think of, oh, they're so gruesome, they're so violent, they're so, oh, who taught them? Whose pattern are they following? Certainly not Jesus' pattern. This is the backdrop to the 1500s that were so tumultuous in Europe. By this time, force, power, prosperity, and the superstitions and traditions of 900 years had so corrupted the ancient harlot that many thinking people could no longer just go along with her anymore. This is sometimes called the Reformation period. There were many small movements all over Europe and elsewhere that arose. Some were very good and valid attempts to bring positive changes. Some were unspeakably gross and cultish groups that end up being as bad or worse than the state church they were fleeing from. The main directional differences fell into three main camps: traditional Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, Protestant Reformation churches like the Lutheran Reformed, and then also the Radical Reformationists, Swiss Brethren, Mennonite, Hutterites, and other Anabaptist groups. The Catholic goal was the same as it had been for over 900 years: maintain authority, control of the ignorant masses, and squash all rivals with fear of torture and the sword. The Reformers saw the error in that path and wanted to point men to faith in Jesus Christ, refocus on the Bible, and a return to the way it was in Augustine and Jerome's days. They sort of said, the old building is not all bad, it just needs to be remodeled. The radical Reformationists agreed with the Reformers in many points, but instead of going back to Augustine and Jerome's days, they wanted to recover primitive apostolic Christianity from the first two centuries. They didn't believe the building was on the foundation at all anymore. The foundation needed to be rediscovered, the rubble cleared away, and the building rebuilt according to the original pattern, as Jude says, earnestly contend for the faith that was once delivered to the saints. Under the feudal systems of that time, very few of the lords who owned all the land and nearly owned all the peasant serfs who farmed it were mostly part of the traditional state church mindset. A few ventured to become Protestant, but it was very rare to find any that were Anabaptists or sympathetic to them. These lords in their stately castles derived their income, power, and wealth by cooperating with the state churches to control the serfs. Many also made armies of the young men that were under their control. This served to protect their own investments from attacks of the other lords or the ever-present threats of the Muslim Turks. Some also made considerable income by farming their young men out as mercenary soldiers to fight some other lord's battles. Needless to say, they didn't want to hear their men telling them, "We have come to make Lord Jesus Christ our king, and we aren't willing to go against our conscience to bear the sword for you anymore." It was a very, very unpopular stand to take in Switzerland and most of Europe. There were few places this new doctrine ended up being more fiercely contested than in Switzerland. Separation of church and state, believers' baptism, salvation through Jesus, not the church, etc. All were on trial along with the non-resistance as men and women were getting born again by the Spirit of God. Threats, fines, arrests, horrible tortures, deprivations, enslavement sent to row the Italian galley ships, property and child confiscations. Would you like your children taken away from you? You won't renounce your faith? We're going to take your children away and we'll place them in a home where they'll raise them for the state. Don't think that's so far away. Don't think it's so far away. So, property and child confiscations. Exile was the last one. They finally saw that killing them and doing everything they could in the land didn't work, so they took everything they had and threw them out of the country, out of the land itself. That couldn't stop the movement as wave after wave of converts arose to fill the gaps of the ones slaughtered or sent away. This would have been bad enough if it had come from the old harlot who was known for this type of behavior, but the deep error of the Protestant view that the old building only needed remodeling became quite apparent as they were some of the worst antagonists and persecutors of the Anabaptist people in Switzerland and elsewhere. Were you aware of that? Our forefathers in Switzerland weren't persecuted that much by the Catholic Church. It was the Protestant Church. In the late 1600s, an English Quaker named William Penn, after hearing the plight of the exiled Swiss brethren sojourning in Germany and France, he came and invited them to come with him to help with a holy experiment in the New World. There was little for our forefathers to lose, so several came, returned good news, then that others came by the droves. Under the Quakers in Pennsylvania, they could own land, work for their own benefit, practice their religion freely without persecution, living by their own good conscience. The potential for getting wealthy in this new world, especially for the second and third generation, who knew nothing of the sorrows and sufferings of Europe, was huge. These people who had prospered spiritually under persecution, would they perish under financial prosperity? And that was a concern already in the 1700s amongst our forefathers. Several concerned Anabaptist leaders had the Dutch Martyr's Mirror translated into German by Peter Miller and printed at the Erfurt Cloister to enlighten the generation to come of the high price paid for liberty of conscience. By the 1770s, a rebellion was brewing among the English Americans that finally erupted into full-blown revolution. The Anabaptists then were again caught in the middle. They had promised to serve the King of England and to be faithful to him, but they were now being pressured and persecuted for not helping the rebellion. Some were publicly humiliated for not mustering to the militia drills. Many had the very accurate Pennsylvania flintlock hunting rifles confiscated. Did you know that in the early days of Pennsylvania, 1700s, the most regarded and respected rifle manufacturers were Swiss Mennonites. They were well noted for their ability to make a gun unlike any other. Their whole concept of rifling was their concept, and it worked. Matter of fact, their guns were taken from them because they were far, far more accurate and had more distance than the smooth bores that the English were using. And so it gave an unfair advantage to the American rebels over the English because they could stand back out of the range of the English guns and shoot the English. So they confiscated the Mennonites, the Anabaptists, because they would have been German Baptists as well, their flintlocks. And the men were left with no hunting rifles. That's all they were using them for. Some were taxed double or more. Some Mennonite gunsmiths were forced out of business for refusing to produce guns for the war. Others were imprisoned or even tried for treason. When the war finally ended, a migration of a large number of Anabaptist people, about 2,000, left Pennsylvania and headed north to Ontario. That had been between 1785 and 1825. You've heard of Kitchener, Ontario, and Waterloo County. That was purchased. 22,000 acres were purchased, and a bunch of Anabaptist people went north. It's because they wanted to follow their conscience concerning the promise of the king to England. Now, yes, there was inexpensive land. Lancaster County was full, and if you think it was full then, you should see it now. but yeah. Meanwhile, another migration of Anabaptists was heading west and south into the Shenandoah Valley. It was not too many years until the country was again in turmoil over a number of issues, none of the least was the enslavement of Africans brought here against their will. Both sides of this conflict, affected by their Catholic or Protestant beliefs, were sure that God was on their side. For those Anabaptists in the north, a fine could be paid that was the equivalent of a year's wages to send someone else in your place when you were drafted. Now, if I gave you the dollar figure, it don't sound like that much money. But I want you to think about what you earn in a year and think about being fined that much so that you can maintain your clear conscience. Would you do it? Would I do it? Could I do it? This was sadly abused, as you were only supposed to be fined once, but some of my ancestors were fined as much as three times, being forced to auction off their farms to maintain their clear conscience. In the South, the Anabaptist people had it much worse. Men were taken and forced into military service, or they had to escape to West Virginia. When the Southern Army came through, they took what they could to feed their troops from the Anabaptist families who were often missing their father and oldest sons. So get it? The fathers and the older sons were either conscripted if they didn't get away, but if they could get away, they went over the mountain into West Virginia. So they left home. Now here are these Anabaptist women and children, Mennonites and German Baptists, there was a lot of them, and they're very vulnerable. The Southern Army marches in and says, we need food. Give us food. And they gave it. But when the North finally came through the Shenandoah Valley, they stole or killed all the livestock, took all the grain, burnt down the mills and the barns, blew up railroads and bridges in a scorched earth policy to leave the Southern Army destitute of sources of supplies. Needless to say, this also left many Anabaptist families destitute of supplies and even a way of earning a living. In the Civil War, the conscientious objector status with the federal government didn't exist yet. Finally, peace was again restored, and aside from a few horrible border skirmishes with the Native Americans, the rest of the 19th century was fairly quiet for the American people, who needed to be occupied with rebuilding the land that was devastated at their own hands. 1914 was the beginning of what the world called the war to end all wars. Many people were needed to fight this horrific war that seemed to include the whole world. COs had it very difficult in this war. Some were imprisoned and badly treated. Some suffered threatenings, public humiliation, and several died at the hands of our military. It can aptly be said of the COs of World War I concerning the price of a good conscience. All gave some, but some gave all. You'll see that on the side of VFW buildings. And I'm not saying it's not true for them, but it's certainly true for the COs. E.J. Schwalm was a young man at the beginning of World War I. He was a River Brethren up in Canada, and the Canadians had a draft, and he wrote an account called Conscientious Objection Under Test. Anyway, in that there were some accounts of individuals who were actually taken to the point of saying, you will put on a military uniform and you will take up a gun, or you're going to the firing squad. And some actually went and stood against the wall at the firing squad, heard the count, heard the shots ring out. They were blanks. They wanted to prove whether or not these men were really conscientious objectors or not. How would we fare? How would we fare? It was at the end of this war that it was decided by the U.S. government that something needs to be established for COs in our land. From World War II up until the Vietnam War, the U.S. Selective Services System has created several programs to try to accommodate the COs, giving opportunity to serve in some way rather than bear arms and take human lives against their conscience. These various programs had different levels of success, but we and the 1Ws who served are grateful to our nation for their desire to understand and work with us. Nevertheless, many Anabaptist churches did need to deal with spiritual casualties from low moral surroundings, lack of accountability, lack of maturity, and incredible temptations found in some of the work that was given to our men. Some failed, lost their way, and never returned. For a time after the end of the Vietnam War, which was from 1955 to 1975, the draft was eliminated. But since the uncertainty of a fully volunteer armed force sufficient to meet all threats loomed over the nation, the Selective Service System was re-engaged to be ready when needed ever since. So maybe you're not aware of it, that the Selective Services has been there ready to do what they need to do if they're called on, but a draft is never more than a few months away. If they get told by the president, I need men, how many days is it, Phil? Do you remember how many days?
190 days.
Like 190 days. They have to have men that are drafted and through the boot camp, ready to go. Okay. Conservative Anabaptist service programs, we're up to us now. It was in 2005, several conservative Anabaptist leaders met to try to decide what to do in the event of another draft. How could we make the 1W experience not only less of a threat to our young people's spiritual condition, but to actually make it a beneficial time in their life and spiritual growth? Is that possible? The Selective Services was willing to talk about it if we do it now. If we wait until there is a draft, it will be too late. After many meetings with the leaders of a few Anabaptist churches and Christian Aid ministries, and then Selective Services, a memorandum of understanding was signed with Selective Services, designating CAM as a potential employer for COs during a time military draft. That all sounds good on paper, but how do we do it when it really happens? The CAS pilot program, a one-month Christian boot camp experience, has been the answer both to our churches gaining the experience to do it and the Selective Services who has access to our training records to know we can do it by the grace of God if and when we need to. Between 2005 and 2015, about 18 conservative Anabaptist churches joined hands together to work for the good of our young people and their conscience in the event of war. In 2015, Deacon Clinton Oberholzer and Rick Hess from Harmony Christian Fellowship, Myerstown, PA, met with Paul and Eli Weaver from CAM, Berlin, Ohio, to discuss the possibility of our church joining CASP. It required several educational trips to Ohio, further discussions with CAM and the board of CASP, who is made up of one representative from each of the other church groups. These need to give approval for any new group coming on. We were eventually accepted and had our first pilot project in 2017, rebuilding homes in flooded areas of Louisiana. Since then, we have been blessed to have a pilot project every other year, Texas, Haiti, and this year it was in Kentucky. The blessing and benefits that we see in our youth and that return from these four-week intensive trainings have been immeasurable. One of the greatest in the depth of the brotherhood that become a part of their experience. Learning to work with each other's personal uniquenesses and even annoyances is something many of us older men would benefit from. And you're allowed to say amen. As of August 2023, the Harmony Christian Fellowship CASP group has rolled its position in the CASP organization over to become the Agape Christian CASP group. Harmony will be the Eastern Regional group for Agape. We are anxious to get the other regions established and ready to do their first pilot projects with CASP. May we all take a part in serving the great King of Kings. May we encourage each other in the way of the Lord, helping each other maintain a conscience void of offense before God and men. So I know that was a little bit long reading, but I think it gives us the foundation we need for knowing what we're here for. So we kind of got that next part there, history of Harmony CASP, wrapped up in the end of that little saying, so we're not going to spend a lot of time there. You've got your Harmony Confession of Faith to look at later. And you all have, if you're here as part of Agape, you have an Agape Brotherhood Agreement. That was also turned over to CASP, CAM, for them to review, to approve that rollover from the Harmony Group, which was approved, to becoming the CASP, the Agape CASP groups. Do you need some more papers? They're over here on the bench, yeah. So, next question. This is an important one for us to answer. What do the following groups have in common? Tampico churches, Maranatha Amish Mennonite, Midwest Beachy Amish, Mid-Atlantic Mennonite, Western Fellowship, Old German Baptist New Conference, Harmony Christian Fellowship, Berea Amish Mennonite, North Michigan Amish, Beachy Amish Mennonite, Midwest New Order Amish, Holmes County New Order Amish, Keystone Fellowship, The Kingdom Builders, Mennonite Christian Fellowship, Pilgrim Mennonite, Midwest Mennonite Fellowship, Bethel Fellowship, Ambassador Amish Mennonite, Dunkard Brethren, and Agape Christian Fellowship churches. What do they have in common? That's right. It's important for you to know who you're working with. They have opened their arms sufficiently to accept us. But I need to ask us a couple questions. First off, I have some answers in multiple fold there. Number one, all of these are conservative Anabaptist churches. They're not old order churches. We don't hate old order people, but the old order people kind of have their own things going, and we kind of let that. But these are conservative Anabaptist churches, which simply means we all believe in the need of a heart-changing conversion and a changed life. Each one is a little different in practical application. As you probably were listening, some of those brought up some people you know. Maybe those were good memories, maybe those weren't good memories, but it brought up some people you know. The difference in application is there, that's real. All participate and work together in CASP. And this is the question: can you and your congregation work with those of other church backgrounds? Now, I want to be painfully honest with us. Can I do that this morning? I came to the charity movement in 1990 out of the Evangelical Church. I already told you that. One of the negative points that I saw was a spirit of exclusiveness. We have it, and you'd all be much better if you were one of us. And can we be honest enough to say that we've had enough churches blow apart at the seams over the last 30 years that we don't have it all together? We aren't the only ones. And some of the places that we ran away from actually had some truth to share. I'm not suggesting a return, but I am suggesting that we need to, since they have opened their arms to embrace us, we need to open our arms and also embrace them. Because I'll tell you how it works. In the end, when it all narrows down and the world is pegged against the last believers, they're not going to care whether you're Mennonite, Amish, Agape. They're going to throw you into one bag. And if you haven't learned not to scrap before you go in the bag, it's not going to be pretty in there. It's important. If you say, I just can't work with these people, then I'm going to suggest don't be a part of CASP. I have been so richly blessed since coming out to the CASP meetings for this reason. One of my introductions to the plain world was, wow, these people split and splinter over every little difference. Some I understood, some I didn't understand. And then the better I got to know, the more I realized that sometimes we think we're splitting over doctrine, we're really splitting over personality issues that we have not resolved. God forbid. Go back to the song that we sang. God forbid that we mar the brotherhood that way. God's vision of brotherhood is bigger than agape. It's got to be. And so we need to expand our vision, too, if it's not already there. I don't know most of you brothers. I'm not accusing anybody of anything. Just simply saying, as we're going forward, this is the course we need to chart. We need to chart it if we're going to succeed in this thing. So let's talk about the discussion on Agape CASP regions. Let me grab my paper here. I had mentioned that we have an eastern region now, instead of it being the Harmony CASP. That eastern region includes Harmony Christian Fellowship, Emmanuel Brotherhood Church, which is up in Rome, Living Hope Christian Fellowship, Peace Anabaptist Brotherhood, Oasis Christian Fellowship, and grieves me to say, we did have part of us was Ephrata Christian Fellowship, who was recently set off due to some issues of direction in the ministry there. So Ephrata is no longer a part of our CASP unit. And then we have some satellite groups that we work with. Danby Christian Fellowship is a church plant in Vermont, too far away to be part of our committee, but we do allow them to participate, send young people. We had some great young people come to our last project from Vermont. And then Lighthouse Christian Fellowship from Maine, again, too far away to be part, but we've had a great house parent couple come from Maine and did a great job down in Haiti for us. And then Joy Anabaptist Church down in Texas. Brother Sutherland, you're probably familiar with that one, aren't you? Eldon Hooley? No? Okay. All right. Anyway, so now what we need to do, we know who the eastern region is. We need to know who the other regions are. And just for the point of starting the discussion, we've been talking a little bit with Brother Mark here and trying to figure out how's the best way. It takes five churches. You know, you're going to be under the big umbrella of Agape, and we've got lots of churches.
Minimum,
I'm sorry, yes, thank you. It takes a minimum of five churches. So it may be more than five, that's not a problem. Now, I do say this, once you get up to about 10, you're going to have the unhandy responsibility that I had as chairman, and that is writing letters to young men who applied, had totally clear applications, and could have gone, but we didn't have room for them. So, somewhere 5 to 8 is a real good number, but if you have more, it's okay. You can work with it. It's going to depend on the dynamics of each one of your congregations. Maybe you have a lot of draft age young people. Maybe you don't. So anyway, here was what we kind of thought about. Central region churches, Ohio, would be Faith, Shining Light, Bethlehem, and then Michigan, Redeeming Love, Millington, New York, North Lawrence, not sure where they're at. I don't know. Did they make a commitment to Agape at this point? Don't know. In case they would, that's probably where that would fall. Then a Midwest region of Bern, Indiana, Keystone, Allen County, Concord, Dayton, Worthington. And apparently Allen County has a new outreach, so they would kind of go in there too. Gospel Light, Zion with Iowa, and Missouri, Emmanuel, would all come together in that Midwest. Now, these are proposals. If we go with these things, what we'll do is start that way, and as the churches grow and develop, we can subdivide and make other groups. But we need to start somewhere, and so this was kind of something we put together. And then a southern region churches, Kentucky. Conrad, good to have you here. Kentucky. So Liberty, Poplar Hill, Gravel Switch, the new outreach from Liberty. Does that have you covered pretty good down there? All right. And then Tennessee, Woodbury, North Carolina, Cornerstone, if they could make a southern region. And I don't know what you all are doing currently. In the eastern region, our CASP group matches up with our Agape ministers group. And so the ministers of that region meet regularly. They meet regularly. We on the CASP committee probably meet in person at least once a year, and on the year we're doing a project, probably more like twice a year. But the idea of having the region is so that we don't have people having to travel halfway across the country to get to a committee meeting. We want to try to get away from that if we can. It's a burden in many ways. So what are your thoughts? Are any of those groups that we laid out there undoable, or you see a problem with that? And I should put it this way. I had kind of given some names to this, but I have Joel Miller here in the Ohio as a representative, Jerry Schmucker, Midwest in Indiana, Clifford Gunther, Southern Regions. No, Clifford, not Clifford. I think I got corrected. It's Conrad. Yeah, I've been meeting with that change right away. So what are your thoughts? What are you seeing? Are some of those too big? I wish I did. I should. Maybe we can make some. I don't know. What I'll do, I think what we'll do is if we finalize these this, I will get one emailed out to you. And I'm going to set a tablet out here today. Please sign in. Maybe what I should do is just start that around the room. Sign in, and especially, I'm hard to catch on the phone. I don't carry a cell phone, and I'm much easier to get by email. So, Phil, we got you already. So I'll just pass this around. Just write your name and your church and your email address, and then we'll make contact with you with these if we finalize. And I'm going to probably let you, you know, discuss that and review. I think it makes sense to try to keep the regions a little bit where Agape's settling in with them.
Well, that list.
Yes.
I had a copy of that at the time. Somebody didn't bring it along. Maybe even to have a discussion, it'd be nice to have a copy. I'm not sure. My poor brain. One of the lists just had the three of us, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, which has been a group of three. And it sounds like you have it.
I think if I remember right, the discussion was you don't have sufficient between the three to try to conduct it, so we tagged you on with another until such a time that you decide to go bigger. Yes, Jeremy.
A question I have, and maybe we're going to get to this later, but what about joining up with the pilgrim churches or stuff in our area with this? There's been some discussion in our area about that.
Mm-hmm.
What is the possibility?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about CASP at this point, and we will get into some of that probably in more detail, but the interesting thing about CASP at this point is, we sat yesterday, we had a board meeting over at CAM, and about 20 of us sitting around the table. We're all a little different, and we're all going to respect each other. And we didn't come here to try to change you. And so it's set up in such a way that our pilot projects are usually by our constituency. And so the same thing would be true of the pilgrims. Now, having said that, if we get a draft tomorrow, it starts the process rolling, and we have, between all the churches represented, some 4,000 young people. If a percentage of those get drafted, we will probably have to work across the lines of constituencies. So that's why it's important the board looks at this and says, do we want this group being a part of us? If we get to the draft and we have to all be together, do we feel comfortable with that happening? So that's one of the reasons that's not normally done, but I won't say it's impossible. Because there are some situations where, let's say it's a homeschool family, home church family somewhere that has a son and they want to send, they call Phil. Phil will send them out to someone in that region and see if there's a chance that maybe they can latch on. They fill out an application, the application comes through good, and they've got room, they can take them. So, yes, there is that possibility. But I'm going to say in a conference as big as Pilgrim, they're probably not looking for extra ASWs. Yes?
Just reflection, maybe you can help with this a bit, Phil, but here locally we have Emmanuel Christian Fellowship, there James Martin. I think they moved, were in contact with you some. They would like to be a part, they're not necessarily part of the copy. They like to come under the past. And I think there was some discussion about joining up. If you can just explain some more what the expectations or what the thoughts or what, you know, what are the expectations when it really comes to that?
Right. Well, the expectation, as I can share, and Phil may have some other things to add to that, but if they fill the application out and your local committee feels comfortable to take them under your wing, they're willing to sign and accept the handbook with the standards expected of them. We don't say they have to be a member of one of your churches, but that's really up to the local committee to have to do that. Even from a national standpoint, as a chairman sitting in Pennsylvania, I don't want to have to evaluate whether that neighbor of yours is going to be fit to go along in your group. You'll need to do that in your committee. So there is some room to do it, but I would just say just don't stack your group with a bunch of outside youth and then have to deal with some things later. You know, the other thing is where are they at directionally? I don't know the group. So where are they at directionally? Are they going to be, is the influence of their youth with your youth for a month, elbow to elbow, 24/7, going to be beneficial or is it going to be detrimental?
Right.
You know, so that, you know, that's going to have to be a decision almost made call by call. So I don't know, Phil, do you have any more to put to that? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. I think they have coffee and some refreshments downstairs. Please help yourself, and if you need to use restrooms or whatever, where are the restrooms at?
Could you write the different groups on the board, just for the video? I could possibly print some more out.
Do you have the ability to do that here? Yeah.
Let me see what I can do there.
Okay. You're dismissed for 10 minutes.